Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. In the early 1900s, life expectancy in the U.S. was only about 46 years, and the majority of deaths occurred quickly, resulting from accidents, childbirth, or sudden illness. In 2010, the life expectancy increased to 79 years, and cause of death has shifted to cancer, heart disease, stroke, dementia, to name a few. Now, only 10% of us will die suddenly. The remaining 90% will live with prolonged illness. There is growing concern the care we receive does not reflect our personal wishes because our healthcare system is not currently designed to ask the right questions, and often we've been motivated not to plan in advance or not given an understanding, opportunity, or the means to plan for choices that will sometimes need to be made at some time. Our topic today is advanced care planning, help and hope for those you love. My guest is Dr. Lael Duncan, Medical Director of Consulting Services for the Coalition of Compassionate Care of California, or the CCCC. Before joining CCCC in 2014, Lael was co-founder and medical director of Good Medicine Consult and Advocacy Services, a practice in the San Francisco Bay Area focused on assisting patients and families with shared medical decisions and value-based care planning. Dr. Duncan is a licensed California physician with over 15 years of clinical practice in internal medicine, infectious disease, and long-term acute care for patients with multi-system disease. Today's show, as usual, is live, and you can be a part of our discussion by calling in with your questions and comments. And to make sure you get on the air, we always ask that you please call in early. The number to call us is 781-3875. And Dr. Duncan, I want to welcome you.
Thank you, Chris. It's really a pleasure to be here.
And I appreciate you calling. You're calling in from Sacramento today, and I appreciate you joining me on the air.
So it's no trouble.
So when we talk, you know, I think the first question here is who or what is the Coalition for Compassionate Care of California, and what is its purpose?
The Coalition for Compassionate Care is a collaborative organization that's been around since about 1998. And our general mission is to improve quality of care in serious illness and at end of life. And the way that we do that is by running a number of different programs. Many of them are grant funded. We promote and support important legislation. We provide feedback to legislators. We conduct educational programs and in many different venues. We're involved in community infrastructure and coalition building. We are the home for the POLST form, which is that special medical order sheet that we may be talking about today.
Right.
And we do all of the official education for the POLST form and many, many other things. We provide resources online as well as regular webinars and conferences to support the work that we do to educate both the public and providers about how to improve quality of care in serious illness and at end of life.
Great. So when we're talking about, so we can get started, when we're talking about advanced care planning, what exactly are we talking about?
Advanced care planning is really a process that allows people to think in advance about what they might want in terms of medical care in the future, and then to communicate and perhaps document that information. And that process and everything that's related to it in terms of conversations and documents and any legal forms or medical orders or notes is called or can be called advanced care planning.
Okay, are we just talking about somebody deciding what they want for the end of life?
No, and that's a common misconception when we talk about advanced care planning. The truth is that most of us, because of the data that you've already pointed out, as we're living longer and we're living with more significant illness burden into the later years of our life, we will come upon a time in our life when we'll need someone to speak for us. That might just be in a surgical setting. It might be in and around an accident or a trauma or a sudden illness. That might be something from which we recover completely, but maybe not. It might be something more serious, and it might be at the end of life. But most of us at some point in our life will not be making our own medical decisions. So unless we discuss those plans and wishes with someone else who's going to be speaking for us, then we don't have a strong chance of having our wishes followed and honored. And the advanced care planning process is really designed to help people anticipate that eventual need and to communicate with their decision makers and their spokesperson and their families about what they might want and have those conversations be really meaningful in a way that will support the care that they want to get in the future.
There's a lot of confusion, I think, around this topic, and it seems to get commingled with so many other things.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that in the work that you're doing, that there's confusion about what advanced care planning is and who should have it?
I do, yes. And I think that comes from a number of different places. First, because it is a broad process. Because it's not one program, it's not one plan, it's not one document, but it really is a concept and a process. I think there's confusion that comes from that side of it. I think there's confusion for people who think about future health care and mm-hmm. not knowing what their treatment options are going to be. And none of us can imagine in 20 years or 10 years or 5 years what the latest and greatest innovations will bring for us. And so thinking about that future piece and thinking about how that care might unfold is often difficult and confusing for patients. Also, because in advanced care planning, we do teach and educate about the concept of palliative care, which is care designed to reduce symptom burden, and also hospice care, which is very specifically a type of care given at the end of life, that there's confusion around those definitions.
Right.
And there's confusion about when the transition from palliative care to hospice care occurs and when palliative care should be used. And so a lot of the terms are confusing for people, yes.
Yeah, and what evidence is there that there's a need for advanced care planning? Are you seeing that there's more evidence in the healthcare system itself? And if so, what kind of evidence?
So the evidence comes from two places. I think you can look at the statistical longevity and life expectancy data that you brought up.
Mm-hmm.
And if we look at that a little bit more closely, we do see in the last 120 years or so that the causes of death have really drastically changed and life expectancy has increased. And in the context of that, it's important to understand that medical care itself has advanced so much that we're really getting very good and quite expert at treating some of the more common ailments that we face. So there are a lot of good interventions and medication for heart conditions and heart disease, a lot of treatment for stroke patients. Really amazing, amazing work has been done in the area of cancer treatment, and patients really are living longer and responding to therapies. Whether or not they ultimately die from their disease, they often live 2, 3, 4, 5 times as long as what they might have been expected to live even 20 or 30 years ago. But where we haven't made a lot of progress is just debility due to the aging process. And in particular, we haven't made progress in terms of really diagnosing well and early diseases of dementia and cognitive impairment and disability due to all the degenerative diseases of the mind and the nervous system. We can diagnose these better. We do manage many of them better in terms of symptom management, but Alzheimer's in particular, as an example, we do not really have any effective long-term treatment for that disorder. There's no way to cure it, just like there's no way to really cure someone of a chronic heart condition. So
mm-hmm.
although people are getting better treatment and they're living longer, they still do have their diseases. And in the case of Alzheimer's, we know that their health will decline over a particular trajectory. And because many of us have successful treatment in the areas of cancer and heart disease, our risk of living to a time when we have Alzheimer's, dementia, or disability from aging is very, very much increased. So that brings up that that statistic that you mentioned, that, you know, we really are living longer, and we're living to an age where we are more affected by our illness and more disabled at the time of our death very often.
One of the things that occurs to me as I hear you talk about what you just spoke about is that if I were to delay making decisions about what are specific wishes that I want, you know, specific goals of care, and we'll talk a little bit more about what that means in just a moment, but specific wishes that are unique to me and my set of values, and I were to be affected by Alzheimer's, I'm no longer in a position that I can make those kinds of declarations, if you will. And there's a missed opportunity for me to be able to really express what's important to me. And am I making myself clear to you here?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So that's very true. And, you know, that's in a sad case that I can tell you. There are many patients and family I've interacted with who have had within their family member diagnosed with a dementia-type illness, very often Alzheimer's. And, you know, those diagnoses usually get made many years in advance of nursing home care and final disability and death. And all of those years, very often the conversations that we are talking about today are quite frankly avoided.
Right. Yeah.
And they're too intimidating. And then suddenly something happens, which is, it happens suddenly. I say that, but in fact, it's very predictable because we know what happens with these patients. And then everyone is standing in the room wringing their hands and saying, I wish we had talked about this before now.
Right.
And it's water under the bridge at that point.
And that something may be that it's a patient who has Alzheimer's or some other form of dementia, and they have a major fall, a broken hip, or they get pneumonia.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, we have a call from Tom. I'm going to get Tom on here. Tom, can you hear us?
Yes.
Okay, great. Did you have a question or comment?
Yes, ma'am. What you're speaking about happened to my mother last week. My mother...
I'm sorry.
...is gone now.
I'm sorry, Tom.
She had a fall. I did not realize it, but for the last 6 months, she started to suffer from dementia. And she had a fall. She broke her leg. She was on Comatin blood thinner due to a heart valve she had. And while in a care facility, while taking physical therapy, she had a mild stroke. But because of the blood thinner, she bled out so quickly in her brain that there was nothing the doctors could do.
Mm-hmm.
And she was gone. And it was the next day when the final test came back that there was no brain activity, the final test. And of course, my older sister wanted to continue life support, but my mother always said that if she was gone, she didn't want to be artificially kept alive.
Mm-hmm.
So a few days ago, my father disconnected life support. But it got to the point, and I wasn't aware of this, and even before she had this fall, she was suffering from dementia. And it was very difficult for my father to take care of her.
Mm-hmm.
And even before the fall, and this I just found out last night, my brother was telling my father that he would be willing to help financially to move them into a semi-care facility, and he would help compensate financially for the cost of such a facility. And I think that one of the reasons that people may not want to go to a care facility is maybe the cost. Maybe that even though they realize that they do need a facility for somebody who may be suffering from dementia like my mother was and gradually getting worse, that maybe they're worried about the cost. I don't know if that's an issue or not with people, but my father was having a very difficult time, and I just found this out. My father is 10 years older than my mom. He's 89 now. And he was taking care of my mom, who was 79. And it must have been very hard for him.
Yeah. Tom, first, I'm sorry for your loss. I'm so sorry. And Dr. Duncan, did you want to say anything here about this?
I'll let you go.
Yeah.
Now,
thank you, Tom.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yeah, so thank you for that really touching story. And it brings up so many, many, many issues. I want to be very supportive of the family. They made what was obviously a very, very difficult and brave decision. But it sounds like from what Tom said is that they took the lead for their decision off of something his mother had shared with him when
verbally
she had said, "If I'm not with you, I don't want to be kept alive." And it sounds like they had at least that piece of information that could help guide them in that, you know, which was obviously very, very desperate and sounds like a terminal situation. So that's an important point. He did have a little bit of information, and that was despite the situation. He mentioned cost. It's true that in end-of-life care, it can get very expensive. Home care is very expensive. Some of the more common reasons that patients get transferred or family members get transferred into a care facility of one type or another is that they are no longer safe in the home, or that is the most feasible way for them to achieve a 24-hour caregiver situation. And it is something that I think most of us think we wouldn't want to be taken from our families in our homes, but it's very, very important that we do think about it because of the types of illnesses and disabilities we may face in our later years. It may be more cost-effective or, quite frankly, safer or less burdensome for our families if we're not living at home. And those are some of the things that we try to talk about when we talk about advanced care planning so that families can anticipate the need for these services and think about what they and their loved ones might want should those options be offered to them.
Well, and without even having the initiation of the conversation, it's very difficult to even look at what the different alternatives are.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You are listening to Central Coast Voices, and I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. Our topic today is advanced care planning, why it's important for all adults, and the ramifications of not planning in advance. My guest is Dr. Lael Duncan, who is joining us by telephone from Sacramento. Dr. Duncan is the Medical Director of Consulting Services for the Coalition of Compassionate Care of California and a licensed California physician with over 15 years of clinical practice in internal medicine, infectious disease, and long-term acute care for patients with multi-system disease. Tom called in just a little while ago and shared a recent experience he had with a lack of advanced care planning by his family and how they coped. Have you had a situation where advanced care directives have made a difference or the lack of them have made a difference for you? We welcome your comments or questions today for Dr. Duncan about our topic and would love to hear from you. Call us at 781-3875. Dr. Duncan, I have a more personal question for you too. It is not the norm for all physicians to kind of answer this calling that you have around what you're doing right now. Was there something in your practice? Was there something in your medical career that steered you in this direction?
I think there were a number of things, Chris, and, you know, some of them were personal and many of them were professional. But in my line of work as an infectious disease consultant and then a hospitalist and a physician in long-term care, I really did see over and over and over again how the system was just not serving the patients very well in certain ways, and particularly in complex illness and at end of life, I would say 99% of the families that I dealt with were completely unprepared for what they were facing. And they struggled with even the simple foreseeable decisions because they simply had never been educated about it, never had the opportunity to talk about it, never had the opportunity to ask their loved one or to be guided by their life values. And the situations that I saw were harrowing. It just broke my heart. And I began to feel that putting into place for all of us at a local, state, or national level, putting into place a form and a recognition of advanced care planning as a vital and integral part of healthcare from start to finish, that could really be a game changer for all of us, not just in terms of quality of care that's given in the hospitals, but more goal-oriented care. It's better for the families. We know this from studies. There are numerous resources now that show us that careful planning and good conversations reduces stress, leads to clearer decision-making, reduce the burdens of cost and care transfers in end of life. It promotes quality of life in many, many ways. So we can measure these benefits now. And building these systems and reducing the barriers and normalizing the conversation in and out of the hospital is just something that I'm really deeply committed to at this point.
When you talk about quality of life, is it the same for everybody?
No, it isn't. And that's, again, another reason why communication is so important. I can't, even knowing you as I do professionally and as a colleague, Chris, I couldn't guess what you might want under certain circumstances or what's right. most important to you or what defines a best day for you. And unless we ask people those questions, we really don't know. And, an interesting sidelight to that is I work with, of course, families and spousal couples and so on. And we think that the people who we love and who love us back or who we're close to or who we've lived with for 20 or 40 years know us very well. Mm-hmm. But in fact, very often people don't predict correctly what their loved one or spouse would want in terms of either care in serious illness, life-sustaining treatments, or end-of-life care. So it really is important to ask and talk about it. We cannot assume that just because we love and know someone generally or socially that we know what they might want. And I think that has to do with a lot of things, faith and spirituality and our basic understanding and trust of the medical system, our subconscious and conscious ideas about how we want the end of life to unfold for us, what we think individually would be most important if we were critically ill. All of these things are very hard to predict for an individual person.
And you talk about goal-oriented care. Define that. What is that?
Well, I think the best way I can define it is to give you an example. Imagine a patient who has a risk for stroke disease, and she's quite elderly or he's quite elderly, and they recommend putting on maybe a mild blood thinner or something similar to what Tom's mother was on, and yet she also has, a fall risk. And I think Tom's story, this is one thing Tom's story brought out beautifully, talking about the risk of the fall and the risk of the blood thinner and sitting down with your provider and really trying to understand what that quality of life piece plays into it. Would you want to take the risk of a stroke and not have the blood thinner on board, or would you have the blood thinner in your system knowing that it was most important to you to prevent your ability to think and do things and take the risk of a fall? Mm-hmm. So choice A or choice B, there's no right choice. There's only a choice that feels good for the patient. And, Tom's mother unfortunately had a really, really severe event, but I know that there are some people, and maybe Tom's mother would even have said, that was tragic and frightening, but I would rather have had a sudden and quiet death than have had to live with many, many strokes and perhaps not be able to communicate with my family at all. Now, of course, I am not guessing what might have gone on in that family, and I don't mean to imply that I know or understand the motivations of Tom's mother, but I'm giving that as an example to point out that the decisions about your care, whether or not to embrace a medication that has bothersome side effects or will prevent you from doing other things, those are very individual decisions. And sitting down and talking about the risks and benefits, and that is one thing, and the providers are very good at doing that, but then looking at those risks and benefits in terms of what has value in your life, that's goal-oriented care.
Right. Okay.
And, you know, another example of that would be it towards end of life. People talk about wanting to live as long as possible under any circumstances, even if they're unconscious. Mm-hmm. That's one value. Other people might say, no, I'd prefer to take a different path. If I really had lost the ability to communicate with my family, I might want to consider some different treatment options, and they would want to ask and find out about that.
And you, as you pointed out, there is no correct answer. It's what is your value and what quality of life is for each individual.
Exactly. And having that information is so helpful for the family, but also for the providers. I mean, as you know, the default is always to treat.
And I was going to ask you that. So if you could
explain
that, because people don't understand that.
If you don't make a choice, the default in the system is to receive fairly aggressive care, most things that are available.
Meaning that if the physicians do not know what your wishes are and they're faced with making the decision, they will default to using the most aggressive treatment.
Yes. Okay. In general, that is true. And then often it gets very confusing and difficult for families. But in general, the default mode is to provide treatment. And, you know, there may be burdens or discomfort with that treatment, or it may lead to a result that that patient would have wanted to avoid had they been able to make an informed choice.
Yeah. We have a couple of calls on the line, Dr. Duncan. I'm going to take one from Liz in Sacramento. Liz.
Hi there.
Hi there.
I'm 35 and I'm married, and I want to know when I should start working on an advance directive and how often does it need to be updated, and also does it need to be signed by a lawyer?
Yeah. Three good questions, Liz.
Yeah, those are very good questions. Thank you, Liz. So Liz is young. Obviously, at her age bracket, say 25 to 45, you know, the major causes of death at that time are generally accident and trauma. So we think that as soon as anyone reaches the adult age of 18, they should at minimum have an advance directive which indicates who should speak for them in the event they cannot speak for themselves. And this legally appoints a spokesperson who is also called a durable power of attorney for health care. There are many terms for that person, but they are basically a spokesperson for you in health and when you can't speak for yourself. And also in that age range, we ask that as part of advanced care planning, people consider the possibility of serious brain trauma. That's really the one illness, the one complication that can come up where care providers and family also would really benefit from having some guidance from the person in terms of the type of care that they want. We saw this play out in the news dramatically in the early cases in the 70s and 80s with Nancy Cruzan and Karen Ann Quinlan and Terry Schiavo.
Right.
Those were all young people who ended up with some form of severe brain impairment after various types of illness and accident. So naming an agent, having an advance directive legally, and then also indicating to your spokesperson what kind of care you would want if you lost serious brain function. And we think you should start doing that at age 18. As you go through the healthcare system, you know, I think at a young, healthy age, probably every 4 to 5 years is reasonable to revisit your directive and make sure you've got the right person on that page and you don't want to change things around. And then absolutely, you should revisit these documents anytime a new illness or new diagnosis is made. or if there's a change in family structure, such as divorce or emancipation of an adult child or a death in the family, where you want to be sure that the person that is on your document is still living and capable and available to you to be your agent. And then, of course, if you have a diagnosis, if it's a serious one that's going to impact your life, you may want to reflect on that and learn about that from your providers and let that information help you inform your agent about what kind of care you would want. As we get older and our care gets more complicated, it's really important to talk about these issues with your spokesperson, with your healthcare agent, at least once a year, just to be sure you're all on the same page going forward. And no, you don't need an attorney in our state. That's important. These really are documents that belong to you, the patient, the person. They don't belong to anyone else. And there is a legal format for filling these out, which can be done even in your own home with witnesses. And the description of that is really well provided. Advanced directives are available online. I'll give you some resources for that, but they're certainly on our website at the Coalition of Compassionate Care, which is coalitionccc.org. You might also look under Caring Connections, which is a program by the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization. They have lots of resources. That address is caringinfo.org. And they have information there about hospice and home nursing, but they also have a lot of information about advanced care planning. So you can download and get copies of documents. You can read about advanced care planning. You can fill these out in the comfort of your own home. And there are directions there as to how to choose appropriate witnesses and have them signed. The other option is you can have the document notarized. And once that's done, that legal document is yours, and it's valid in the state of California.
Answer okay, your you. Questions, Liz?
No, that's it.
Great.
I thank you.
Great. Thanks for calling. And then we have a call from Meredith from Paso Robles. Meredith, are you there?
Yes.
Hi. Did you have a question or comment?
Yes, I have a comment. I just would like to underscore listening to Tom and, of course, your wonderful, knowledgeable speaker from Sacramento. So much information, but I would just like to reiterate how important it is. We had the document for my husband's father. He had Alzheimer's. We took care of that when he was of sound mind and asked what he wanted. He didn't want to be on life support. My husband, it's a difficult decision to make in the moment, and it was just the two of us. You would think that we would have gotten it right. when he had he had Alzheimer's, he had a heart attack in the center, and he was in the emergency room, and we had a fantastic doctor who took me aside first and gave me very accurate information that my father-in-law's heart attack was massive, that there was, more than one artery involved, and that he thought that he said we can keep him comfortable and let him pass. So it wasn't my father, so I passed that information along. So I said to the doctor, yes, I think that's what he would have wanted, but my husband is the person who has that say legally and also emotionally. And it didn't, my husband didn't hear it, I guess. I mean, he says he didn't hear it. He didn't understand. All he heard was in his heart that his father was, had a massive heart attack. And, he said, and his response was, do what you can. And so here's three people, actually, if you include my father-in-law who planned ahead, had the document. But in the moment, all those emotions, mm-hmm. and he passed quickly, but he was very frightened and had some surgery that was probably unnecessary. My husband and I did our best. We're there with him. He had to be restrained, which was horrible because of his Alzheimer's, and he was so strong in body. And so we did it right. You know, we stayed with him and guided him through his passing in the most beautiful way. And we did feel his body. We did feel him relax. He knew that we were there. So we did the best that we could. But in retrospect, 10 years ago, my husband still says to family members, he wished he'd done it differently. He wished he had just not even been asked by the doctor, what do you want to do? And here was this doctor who was giving us very good information and being very, you know, genuinely human, concerned, you know, in the moment. And I can imagine what that must be like with siblings, mm-hmm. You know, siblings involved in the room. So I really feel for what Tom went through, and I'm so glad that he feels that he made the right choice. But I will say, and I do want to end with reiterating that the documents are so important, even with what I said, you know, because there's peace of mind, and when there are siblings involved and other family members, it just makes it so much simpler for everyone to at least get to the point where someone says, what are we going to do? And the choice is so emotional. I guess that's my point. It's a very emotional choice, and no one should have to make that choice without knowing what their loved one wanted. That's a very important piece of information. So anyway, that's my comment. I'm glad you're doing the show. And I think everyone should plan ahead and think about this and not leave it to the last.
That's
my comment.
Thank you, Meredith. I really appreciate your comment and for you to share your story.
Yes, thank you, Meredith. Once again, really a beautiful, beautiful, touching story that point. In the moment, that phrase, it is really so difficult for families to make these decisions, even when there have been conversations and even when there are documents. And I think this points out once again that having done nothing is just really going to make that in the moment piece that much harder. And we don't want our loved ones to die. I mean,
right.
That's usually the case. I think sometimes there's a recognition that they are ready to go, very elderly, very ill person, certainly. But we as an American culture have a hard time talking about and dealing with death on many levels. And it's frightening when you're there in the moment and
it
you're
is.
Facing really serious illness. To have the opportunity at that time to speak not for yourself, but to be speaking in the voice of the patient and to be able to say what they would want is not only empowering, but really is giving them such a gift in their life or at the end of their life. We know that it can relieve these burdens of regret that families feel. When they feel they haven't known what someone's intentions or wishes were, there's a lot of complicated bereavement and depression and terrible lifelong regret that families live with when they struggle with these decisions. And advanced care planning and advanced care communication can relieve a lot of that. I know, and I'll be one of the first to admit, that our system, our health system, and all of our providers across the country, they are not all trained to have these conversations.
No,
some
in
are,
fact, the most of them are not.
And some aren't. And
yeah.
Most of them are not.
Right.
And we as patients and family members need to be proactive. This movement of embracing advanced care planning and talking about age and death in a way that allows us to reclaim it and plan for it is really important, and we the public, we the patients, we the families, we are part of that. And as we start this and continue this work, I think more and more providers will be given the opportunity to learn how to do this. They're starting to teach it in medical schools. I think patients will become more familiar with what they can ask for in a hospital, talking to a social worker, speaking with a palliative care physician, just taking a time out, or even just remembering to say, well, what is a different option? Or if we don't treat aggressively, what is that going to look like for my father or for my mother? And can you help me understand how this choice would fit for them if they told me, they didn't want to be kept alive on life support, but I don't know what to do in this moment about the heart attack. But I know my dad said he didn't want to be on life support. So can you help me understand how to translate that information into something that makes sense for us right now in the moment?
I think what was so sweet about what Meredith spoke about with the conversation that the physician had with the family was that he presented a look at the situation from different angles and presented this could happen if you do this. This could happen if you do that. So that it's looking at the building from all sides rather than just looking through it, the front door. And I think, you know, from my perspective, what we see often is one-dimensional view of the options that we've got. And it is sadly lacking.
Well, and things happen really fast.
Yes, of course.
And very often that's appropriate, and very often we can't predict what the outcome would be. I think certainly with the younger, more vital person, our tendency is to be, you know, to want to be very aggressive for a very, very long time.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, with an older, very, very frail person, we want to be a little bit more gentle, but we might be providing very, very aggressive, very advanced care over a period of time. But what we would want to know from that patient is, gosh, you know, now you're getting all these kinds of care. Are there circumstances that might come up that would cause you to change your opinion about the type of care that you're getting or to try to avoid some of the treatments that you've already had or anything else? So that idea of, again, sort of taking a time out and reassessing where we are and where we want to go, what are the goals of the care, what's happening, revisiting the burdens and the benefits of what's being offered, talking about realistic probabilities, and then trying to make those choices fit with what's really most important for someone. And maybe what's most important is getting home for a few weeks, or maybe what's most important is getting back on the golf course, or maybe what's most important is just being able to watch that Sunday football game sitting in a lounge chair. And it's different for everyone.
Exactly.
And the way that we approach that care can be different for everyone.
So how do you help your patients understand what choices are right for them?
Well, it's a lot of homework for them
in one
instance, and maybe I shouldn't use that homework phrase. I think probably we all have a negative response from many years ago. But,
yeah, if it's going to be work, forget about it.
I'll rephrase that. It's an opportunity for them to really think about what matters in their lives.
Yeah.
And this can be really a pleasurable experience for people. Many people are so intimidated even to start these conversations with their family.
Yes.
But then they get into it and they realize that, wow, you know, we're actually just sitting around talking about what matters most.
Yes.
What matters most?
Yeah.
What foods do you like? What things do you like to do? What do you care about? What makes you happy? What's a really good day? And that's how you start. You think about what your values are and what has meaning for you. And you take the opportunity to discuss that with your family. And then you maybe bring in some of the medical decisions that might be made. But most importantly, again, you talk and you communicate and you choose a spokesperson, and then you create the necessary documents, an advance directive, or perhaps a physician's order regarding life support if that's available in your area, which is in California. And then you have something of a plan.
There is a website for those people who enjoy websites called theconversationproject.org. And it actually is a user-friendly website, correct?
Yes, that's a good website, and I often refer people to that one. So that's theconversationproject.org, and their mission is to help normalize this conversation and really help patients and families to have these conversations really right around their kitchen table. And they've got some paperwork and some stories to share and a lot of really good information there to help you get started. Another website that we just love is prepareforyourcare.org, and that is a website that through an interactive video system and some documents that they have will walk people through an advanced care planning process and help them think about some of these concepts. So those are two really good websites to look at.
And the Coalition for Compassionate Care has the documents that you can download?
Yep, we have the documents. We have several different types of advanced directives. Mm-hmm. So you can pick one that looks right or feels right for you. We also have a sheet of instructions on how to choose a good healthcare agent. A sheet of instructions that teaches the agent how to be a good healthcare agent or spokesperson. And we also have on there another thing that you can download that's our conversation guide that gives you some tips and hints for getting the conversation started in your family and for responding to things like when someone says to you, oh, I'm too young, I don't need to do that now.
Let's talk about it later.
I just don't want to talk about that, yeah.
Yeah. You are listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX Public Radio. I'm Chris Kington Barker. Our topic today is advanced care planning, help and hope for those you love. Dr. Lael Duncan, Medical Director of Consulting Services for the Coalition of Compassionate Care of California, is my guest. And we have only about 10 minutes left in the show. I could probably take one more phone call to reach us on air at 781-3875. And we have a call from Susan. I'm going to take that real quick here. Susan, are you there?
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to mention, I as I was waiting to get on, I just realized that you had all this information on the web. My feeling was kind of a film. A film that, say you're not connected to the internet, I know most people are, but if you're not, it's too bad we can't ask Hollywood and all the filmmakers to put together something really beautiful for people to watch. I mean, you can see, you can get it anywhere, not just on the web, you know?
There are films,
a touching film that touches all this and teaches people what to do and what not to do, or however they're feeling at the time or before.
Lael, do you want to speak to like a documentary or something?
Well, there's a good documentary called The Conversation, which has been out for a number of years now, and it discusses advanced care planning in detail and goes through some family stories, and it has been very, very well received. It is available for purchase, and I don't know if that information is on our website or not, but that film is available.
Okay.
There have been a number of films. Some of them have been independent films that address and touch on these issues, and what they probably don't do is really give the instruction that's needed on how to do advanced care planning, but they certainly make clear the case of the need for advanced care planning in many instances.
Yes.
Where there's either traumatic brain injury or a dementia illness or a severe stroke. There was that beautiful French film, and of course I'm forgetting the name of it, where the woman was in declining health. And there are other films that come up. A nice thing about the films is if you can share those with your family, it's often a really good starting place for a conversation.
So
you can elicit people's responses and feelings, and you can start to ask the questions like, well, gosh, if that happened to one of us or to you or to me, what would you want done? What would be important to you? How would you want me to talk to your doctors? What would you want me to say? Those are good starting places for conversations, films, other things that you can use to start a conversation, an event in the news, a shared story, something that has happened to someone you know. We are all of an age, I think, where, you know, we hear about things in the news. We know people who get diagnosed with one thing or another. Sometimes we can use those as conversation openers. Even just saying, you know, hey, you know, I heard so-and-so had to have a such-and-such kind of surgery, and it made me think, what if that happened to me, or what if that happened to you, and I would want to do what you want me to do, so I need to ask you now what's important to you so that I know how to speak for you when the time comes, and that can be a good conversation opener as well. And, you know, while we're talking about the conversations, I want to just make a quick note about how to be very careful in choosing your spokesperson. Really consider that decision very carefully. There are certain qualities that you want that person to have. You want them to be available. You want them to understand your beliefs. You want them to be able to speak for you, even if it might rub up against something that they are conflicted about. So you want to be careful to avoid people who have very spiritual or moral differences of opinion with you, or at least to think about it and consider that the person can really speak for you. They also need to be comfortable being in a hospital environment, need to be comfortable advocating for you with a team of professional providers and physicians, and sometimes that's intimidating. I don't think everyone is comfortable in that role, but a spokesperson would need to be comfortable in that role, so that's something that you want to think about. So just picking the first person that comes into your head isn't always the best way to go. You do want to put some thought into that person who's going to be at the top of your advanced directive there.
And you don't want to just pick a person because of the hierarchy in the family system either. For instance, the eldest child, just because they're the eldest child, that may not be the person that's the best person to speak for you.
Right. And you want to pick the person that's right for you. And then especially if you consider that there might be differences of opinion, it's very important to share your thoughts with other members of the family. I think this comes up most with respect to life-sustaining treatments or resuscitation or something like that. If a family member has made a decision that they do not want those kind of treatments, really important to let other family members know that so that they don't rush into the emergency department and start saying, hey,
counteracting.
Why aren't you treating a grandmother? And that everybody understands that that's part of the care plan. And, you know, that can be one of the ways that you have advanced care planning that's actually going to work for the patient.
Do you advocate for having a secondary decision maker in the event?
Yes. You should always have a minimum two people listed on your directive. One person is top ranked, and the second person is activated if that first person is not available. Some people put a third person on there. What we discourage people is having people list two or three people all simultaneously as having equal say. That's difficult. That decision-making by consensus gets a little bit tricky for the medical team. It doesn't always work. Now, care planning and care conferences and family meetings and all that stuff, everybody can be involved in that, and everybody's opinion can be weighed and counted. But in the end, it's best to have one person who's the main spokesperson, who has the legal authority to interpret and disseminate what the decision of the family is. So we really encourage people not to list all five of their children, but to list one person as a spokesperson. And they can put a note in there that says, I would like for my, you know, son or daughter, whoever it is, to consider the opinions of the other kids when they're ready to speak for me. Something like that. If you feel strongly, you can certainly put that in there. Mm-hmm. And you can educate your own family about how you want that process to be managed.
How now, where should the advanced care directives be kept? Because I've had conversations even with friends that have said, I have an advanced care directive. It's in my file box, my locked file box at home.
Right. So you want to have a card in your wallet that says that you have one. and says where it is, and says who your agent is, who your healthcare agent is, your spokesperson, and then your spokesperson, your healthcare agent, should definitely have a copy.
Okay.
And they should keep and have a most recent copy, because they are the one who's going to get called to the hospital
right.
if you are unconscious or having a drug reaction after surgery or something like that. So they need to have a copy. And then a lot of medical practices are now asking to get copies of those. So you may go into your primary care physician's office, and they may be saying to you now, well, do you have an advance directive? We'd like to keep a copy of that here. If you're doing that, that's great. It's really important. You want to make sure that if you update your directive, you take the most recent one in there and give them an updated copy of that as well. But most importantly, you want a copy, probably a card in your wallet stating your agent's contact information, and then you want your agent, your healthcare spokesperson, to have a copy themselves.
And if you're going to change it, you want to have another conversation with the people that are going to be representing you so
right.
that they understand your changes. And you want to revisit with them when you revisit your healthcare directive, just to make sure that they're still on board with your choices. It may be that their values in life have changed and they no longer can support as strongly carrying out your wishes as they could before.
Very good point. Very good point.
Can you talk, we got just a couple of minutes, but real quickly, can you just say what the difference of a pulsed is and an advanced care
yes.
directive?
So a pulsed form is something that a physician fills out with a patient that is a medical order. The document belongs to the patient. They take it home. It's pink. But it has to be filled out with a doctor. And the purpose of that document is to indicate what types of care would be wanted really in the event of a serious illness or terminal illness. And it's designed to be used primarily with very, very elderly, frail people, or those with an anticipated lifespan of, you know, 6 to 12 to 18 months. In other words, if you knew someone that where you said to yourself, gosh, and I wouldn't be surprised if so-and-so ended up in the hospital terminally ill in sometime in the next 18 months or so, that person should probably have a pulsed form. And the reason that is because if you're likely to suffer a terminal or a life-threatening event, it gives the providers the information to treat you directly, even when, before your spokesperson gets to the hospital. And specifically, the first thing on that sheet is to indicate whether or not you would want resuscitation if you had a natural death event. So, Chris, you and I could probably spend a whole hour talking about the nuances of the pulsed form, but what people need to know is it's really indicated for certain people who are ready to make certain choices about their care. It is a medical order that physicians can act on even before a spokesperson arrives. And it's meant to be kept by the patient at home so that emergency providers and ambulance and so on, that they can find that document and have it with them. It's quite different from an advance directive, but it does support and enhance the advance directive and the advance care planning
and
process.
And we'll do a
We think of it as the last piece of advanced care planning.
Okay, and we'll do a show specifically on that one. I want to thank my guest, Dr. Lael Duncan, and remind you that there are a number of free resources online in your local communities to assist with advanced care planning. I want to thank all of you for listening to this show in 2014. We'll return in January 2015. We have gratitude for all of you for listening. Very best wishes for the holidays. Central Coast Voices is sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities and the San Luis Obispo Community Foundation in collaboration with KCBX. Your suggestions for future show topics are always welcome. Send them to voices@kcbx.org. I'm Chris Kington Barker. Thank you for joining me on Central Coast Voices.